Welcome to the Full Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 4:23 in that specific summer time, standard time, excuse me. And today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio for the various different asset classes. And I apologize for the lateness of the hour. But I guess this being Friday, we won't have new market news until Monday. Well, this has been a very positive week for stock markets generally. The majority have rallied on consecutive days. Wall Street is back up testing the region of its peak with the NASDAQ 100 up around the 4700 area, but not quite there. The S&P 500 up to test the region of the 2100 level. And, well, the S&P pulled back a little bit from that level in here today, but by and large, stock markets have got plenty of room in which to consolidate and still be well above their October lows. And that's thanks to what has been really a very impressive rally. Well, that's certainly the case on Wall Street. Europe has been the subject of pretty negative news flow this week, and not least because of the terrorist attacks on Paris, which really are a travesty, both for in terms of the human toll, but also in terms of highlighting just how porous Europe is to this kind of threat. And then it tends to lead to very emotional commentary, but the real question is, to what extent does that affect consumer sentiment? What kind of effect does that have on spending, or indeed to the manufacturing sector? And realistically, probably very little. What it does mean, though, is that the ECB has plenty of ammunition and plenty of reasons to increase its stimulus. So it's pretty difficult to make a bullish case for the euro in that kind of environment. And because the euro dollar is by far the largest currency pair, then that tends to shape perspectives. What we can see, though, is that the euro stocks index is, and by that I mean the one that has got over 300 shares in it, the broad euro stocks index, and you know, that's a substantial way away from where it was in 2007. And this continues to represent a recovery. And we can look at what's happening in Europe and look at what happened in the USA around 2011 and draw really rather similar parallels, because the market is slowly but surely coming around to the view that the ECB will do whatever it takes, that they will continue to expand monetary stimulus, that they will reflate the size of the ECB's balance sheet to 3 trillion euros, and there is nothing to say that they're going to stop there. And we can, and I think people will be writing their PhD theses and debating for years to come the influence of quantitative easing and this period of history. But what we have substantive evidence of is that quantitative easing has done a wonderful job of inflating asset prices. That's certainly the case in Wall Street. It's been the case in Japan. And there is very little reason to really question whether that isn't going to be the case in Europe as well. So as long as the ECB is printing money, and they're most certainly still doing that, then significant pullbacks in European equities will be regarded as buying opportunities. And of course, just like any other market, that is subject to governance improving. And of course, the Volkswagen issue continues to make headlines, and Bosch is the most recent company that is being investigated, and that highlights that even in highly developed economies, that there really is one has to be eternally vigilant for signs of corruption and shady dealings. That also threw a spanner in the works in terms of the confidence in the German economy, but Volkswagen is certainly a large company, but it is certainly not the only company in Germany, and the DAX is still trading above 11,000 and continues to represent a recovery candidate. When we throw the net a little wider, then the fall in commodity prices has been ongoing now for over 4 years, and we're starting to see that some of these trends have are getting really quite mature looking. And what has certainly become the case is that we have to look at commodities and base our judgment on their individual characteristics rather than taking them as a whole. The commonality, in other words, has broken down entirely. Well, the fall in commodity prices generally, though, has really weighed on the commodity producers, and the slowdown in China's economy has weighed on the vast majority of its neighbors. Europe represents China's biggest trading partner, and the USA is perhaps its second, but it's a major trading partner for the vast majority of commodity exporters, and also for a number of the countries in its hinterland, not least those in the ASEAN region. So the slowdown in China has had a knock-on effect, both in terms of commodity prices, but also in terms of slowdowns and the declining exports for the majority of the countries in its hinterland. Well, then what happens in China does really matter. And you know, we were there just a couple of weeks ago, and what is increasingly evident is that they need looser monetary policy, that just about every business we visited was complaining about how difficult their conditions were, that they lost part of their US business during the credit crisis and their European business during the European sovereign debt crisis, and now with lower commodity prices, they've lost their Russian and Middle Eastern customers too. So the export sector needs lower interest rates. The infrastructure sector needs lower interest rates, and if the domestic consumer is going to take off, then they're going to need access to capital. So China is going to be running a looser monetary policy for the foreseeable future, and in that it will be joined by Europe and by Japan. Well, if that's the case, then the significant pullback that we've seen in Chinese equities has probably gone about as far as it's going to go, and that we're now back on a recovery trajectory, and that's likely to be quite a bit more moderate than the pace of the advance that we saw from about this time last year. Well, the currency, because China is likely to be running a looser monetary policy, then the renminbi is likely to trend lower. But that's going to be a gradual and a measured devaluation. And we've already seen that a number of currencies, not least the Brazilian real, the Indonesian rupiah, the South African rand, and a substantial number of additional currencies, and particularly those in Latin America, have fallen in the region of 50% over the last 3 years. And that's a significant decline in any market, but in a currency, that's a massive move. So you can't talk about currencies in isolation. You have to look at them as a ratio. And certainly the dollar has been firmer, but a number of these emerging market currencies have been substantially weaker. And that is going to reignite their competitive edge. That if you were running a factory in Brazil 3 years ago, well, you are now twice as competitive relative to what you were then because of the decline in the currency and indeed the decline in energy prices. Oil prices hit a low of around $40 about 8 months ago, and it can take a year before the benefits or the full benefits of having a low energy price really begin to filter down into the wider economy. But this has been an incredibly large move, and you're not going to have global investors who have become rather accustomed to having currency market, capital market, and yield in their favor coming back into these markets until they have some sort of real faith that the massive declines that have been posted in emerging market currencies are over. What we've seen so far is that the Brazilian real is unwinding its oversold condition and is still a ways away from its 200-day moving average. The Indonesian rupiah has already unwound that overextension and has the potential to push back above the MA if its more recent action continues. And the rand has been trending lower for a number of years and is now half what it was only 3 years ago, and has already accelerated. So we've already seen very mature declines in emerging market currencies. And if we see evidence that these lows can hold, and it is looking increasingly likely that they will, then this represents really extremely good news for emerging markets. And that's particularly important because emerging markets represent where the majority of the global population lives. And you know, that's important from the perspective of any global investor. And by and large, emerging markets have been totally off the radar. And for at least the last few years, because some of the developed markets have been doing that much better, and particularly Wall Street, which has been just a tower of strength. Well, Wall Street is still holding on to its peak, are holding on to its the majority of its gain. But one has to really question how quickly it will be able to push on to new high ground. Then you look at some of those currencies that are unwinding huge oversold conditions, and obviously you don't have a deterioration in a currency for no good reason. There's going to be plenty of reasons. But you know, at some point, all of that bad news is priced in, and it's looking increasingly likely that we have seen that. So then when you look at, you know, what in economists really think about the outlook for global GDP growth, then there aren't many that are thinking about the potential that it might actually come in above expectations next year. But that is a realistic possibility, that the Fed isn't going to raise interest rates unless they have reasonable faith that the economy is going to be able to handle it. The ECB is going to continue to flood the market with liquidity, and that will help to raise asset prices. And easy monetary policy is likely to be the order of the day among the G7. So we're in a reflationary kind of environment, and you know that's likely to be supportive of global economic figures. And that would be particularly the case if commodities begin to stabilize, and one really has to then look at them individually. When you look at copper, it's been trending lower for 3 years, and it moved to new lows in here this week, and it's down to almost $2 a pound. And it's not so long ago that it was trading closer to $4. So we've had a substantial deterioration in copper prices, and it's still a consistent medium-term downtrend with progression of lower rally highs. So it's oversold in the short term, and it's an approaching a psychological area of potential support, but it will have to do a lot to break that downtrend. Well, iron ore prices are back testing their lows, but that low was back in May. There's been a great deal of negative news about the iron ore sector, but they really would need to break down to reassert the medium-term downtrend, and there's the potential that it could find support. Well, platinum prices have fallen from a retest of about the 1,000 level at the beginning of the month to 855 at today's close, and that's a substantial pullback. Platinum, or palladium, was up by nearly $18 today, and that's also got a short-term oversold condition. Well, in the majority of the industrial metals, then you have these oversold conditions and medium-term downtrends. So there is certainly potential in the short term for some unwinding of that oversold condition, and not least as some of these currencies start to also unwind oversold conditions. But when we look at the soft commodity sector, then we're seeing evidence of greater volatility, and not least because of El Nino. Orange juice is surging higher. Oats is in backwardation and broke out earlier this week. Corn and soybeans are still relatively inert, but coffee, which posted a new low earlier this week, posted its first upward dynamic in nearly 2 months. Cocoa prices are still represent a tower of strength, and feeder cattle, which have been trending lower, also looking like they're finding support. Then we have a major weather phenomenon developing, and that is going to cause greater volatility in commodity prices, and it's looking increasingly likely that trends that were previously overstretched are going to be reversed. So in many respects, the soft commodity sector is perhaps one of the more interesting, because you have really overstretched conditions. Well, somewhere else you have really overstretched conditions is in a number of stock market sectors, and not least biotechnology. It's interesting that biotech was, and I think we were, we did highlight that biotech shares were getting a bit overheated earlier this year, and they have pulled back, but not, well, certainly not all in a similar manner. Biogen had led on the way up and led on the way down, and it's started to find support over the last month. The Nasdaq biotech sector is has experienced a medium-term correction, but it doesn't look like it's anything more than that. And then some of the more over-leveraged companies have experienced extremely steep declines, where you have Valeant Pharmaceuticals down over 70%. So these are massively overstretched conditions. And when you see something like that, there is an element that you may perhaps be gambling and attempting to pick the low. And yet, the question from the perspective of a bond investor is, how likely is it that it's going to go bust? And it's unlikely that it's going to go bust. Then you have to think that how it might have been overcooked, it might have been overheating earlier this year. But how similar is the situation that we have today to what was evident in 1999? And it's really not very similar at all. 1999 was the climax of what had been a 20-year bull market. And certainly the market has been rallying since 2009, but this is only 2015. We're not talking about 2029, and which would have been a 20-year bull market. Then how stretched are valuations? They were stretched, certainly, but certainly not to the same extent as they were back in the Nasdaq bubble. And perhaps more important than that is that these companies really do have products, and these companies really do have earnings. And then the question is how to value those earnings rather than guessing about whether they'll ever have any. And that also is really quite different. Well, let's just imagine that emerging markets do start to do better next year. Then that would be really very positive for the global economy generally. What we have is the standard of living for the vast majority of people in the largest population centers is getting better, and for some people is getting better very quickly. And the number of people living on less than a dollar a day is decreasing all the time. Well, you could be cynical and say that's probably because of inflation, but inflation is less of a problem for those kinds of people. But improving governance can have a profound effect on the standards of living for the majority. And technological innovation is progressing at an increasingly impressive rate. And part of the reason for that is because new technologies are enabling additional innovation and creating new technology. And that's likely to continue. That there were a number of articles over the last 2 weeks talking about the ability of programs and computers to come up with creative solutions, and that is rather new. We've always been able to get computers to do calculation, but it's always been a human endeavor to come up with a creation, and that is no longer the case, and that will also help to enhance the pace of technological innovation. And above all else, technological innovation enhances standards of living. And lower energy prices. We've been writing for over 6 years that unconventional oil and gas would be a game changer for the energy sector, and that's no less true today than it was then. And prices have come down and priced in a lot of that news. And it's perhaps not so much of an important question how low oil prices go. West Texas Intermediate is around $41 right now. It's beginning to find a little bit of support at the lower side of its range. And perhaps the much more important question is not how low oil prices can go, but rather how high will they go once they have bottomed. And in that regard, oil is starting to look a lot more like natural gas. And for the reason I say that is because with natural gas, a great deal of additional supply becomes economic at around $4. So it's difficult for prices to sustain a move above that level, because as soon as prices get up towards $4, then supply starts to increase. Well, one of the characteristics of unconventional oil wells is that the production profile peaks very early, that initially the production is incredibly prolific, but that within 18 months the production profile begins a steep descent. And it means that if you want to continue to grow your production, you have to continue drilling. And that adds to costs in a high price environment. But the flip side of that is that in a low price environment, you can allow the production profile to deteriorate and stop drilling. Then supply will begin to trend lower, and when prices start to recover, then all you have to do is start drilling again, and the supply profile will pick up once more. And then that's very similar to what would have happened with the natural gas market, that at a price, and that price, we won't exactly know where that price is until we see a significant rally, but probably reasonable to think that that price is probably around $60 to $70. That when prices get up to that level, well, then unconventional wells will become profitable once more, and drilling will pick up, and then prices will start to come back down. So we don't exactly know where the low is going to be, and the previous peaks were around $40 in the previous cycle, so they represent a potential area of support, and certainly $40 is a psychological level. And I tend to think that it's probably going to be somewhere between $40 and $35 where prices find support. And we could be in for a lengthy ranging phase, and that range could be 50% from bottom to top, which is where certainly traders can make money, but that investors are going to be probably disappointed. But how oil prices do needn't necessarily mean that oil shares will have a direct correlation. They've cut out a great deal of spending. They've cut out huge costs out of their budget, and they're going to stop investing in new supply. Well, that means that then they're going to have the ability to continue to pay their dividends, and they'll be able to prosper in a comparatively low price environment. Well, we've had a significant rally from the overextended lows that were evident on ExxonMobil, for example. And I think that low is unlikely to be retested at this stage, that it's currently ranging in the region of the 200 moving average, and has been a bit firmer over the last couple of weeks. It means that even in a low price environment, there is room for companies to make money. When we think about the bond markets, then, well, if you look at bunds, then bunds are currently trading around 158, and bund yields were pressuring the lower side of the range in here today, because the ECB will be buying bonds, but they have very little choice in exactly what they can buy, and they'll buy the bonds of the highest rated creditor, and that's Germany, and the Netherlands got its AAA rating back in here today, so they'll be buying those bonds as well. They'd love to be buying asset-backed securities, just like the Fed was able to do, but Europe doesn't really have a mature asset-backed security market, and it means that if one were looking for a business idea for a European bank, then opening an ABS desk would probably be a good idea, because the ECB will buy anything that you issue. They're desperate to get credit moving once more. They need inflation. They've only got one mandate, and that is to court inflation of around 2%, and that's something that they're going to have to continue to try and do. And that means then that they're going to be buying bonds and they're going to be printing money. And that means then that how likely is it that European bond prices are going to change their trend meaningfully? I suspect rather unlikely. Well, then you look at US Treasuries and you're presented with a very different profile, because the Fed is likely to be the first central bank to raise interest rates. They were the first central bank to begin to cut interest rates, and now they're the first to raise interest rates, and the Bank of England probably won't be that far behind. Well, then US Treasuries are unlikely to get back to their lows. And then when we look at that trend, then we're presented with a medium-term progression of higher reaction lows, and that's been evident for nearly 3 years. And it's volatile, and not least because we're at very low levels, and a 20 basis point move looks like a lot. But if you take a step back and you look at the overall profile, then it's looking increasingly likely that this is a base formation, and that interest rates will go up in a gradual manner, and that the chances are that yields will also rise. And that is something that we haven't had for a long time. They cut interest rates, they started cutting interest rates 10 years ago, and or at least close to 10 years ago. And there are a lot of people working in the bond markets today have never seen the Fed raise interest rates. So to think that that is going to pass off without any volatility at all would appear to be really rather Pollyanna-ish, that we have a lot of people working in the fixed income markets today that have absolutely no experience of a rising interest rate environment. And the only trade in town has been to be long and leveraged for the last 10 years. So it isn't beyond the bounds of possibility that there are going to be some investors, traders, and funds are going to get into trouble when interest rates do eventually begin to rise. And that's one of the reasons why the stock market is more likely to range in the short term than to trend higher in a significant manner, just because of this uncertainty. Well, emerging market currencies might be unwinding their oversold conditions, and they certainly have they have fallen a lot, but the dollar has got some fundamental factors that are a benefit to it, and that's likely to be the case for the foreseeable future, that the US economy has got a lot of things going for it, and not least the fact that it has got lower energy prices and a rather wide technological lead relative to the rest of the world. So when we think about it, then the market bottomed in 2009 and broke out to new all-time highs in 2011. And that completed a 13-year process of consolidation, so that this continues to look like the early stages of a secular bull market, but the latter stages of a medium-term cyclical bull market. And it means that we've been ranging for a year, and that we could be ranging for a while longer. But that, generally speaking, significant pullbacks will be buying opportunities, that the rise of the global middle class is going to bring an additional 2 billion consumers into the global economy in the next 20 years, and technological innovation and lower energy prices are the kinds of things that can stimulate the kind of demand growth that really does help to fuel a secular bull market. And I think with that, I will leave you for today, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.